ॐ ज्ञानति मिनन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. Translation: unless the gross materialist develops a sense of loving service unto the Supreme Lord, the seer of both the transcendental and material worlds, he should remember or meditate upon the universal form of the Lord at the end of his prescribed duties. Purport: the Lord is the seer of all worlds, both material and transcendental. In other words, the Supreme Lord is the ultimate beneficiary and enjoyer of all worlds, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. The spiritual world is the manifestation of his internal potency, and the material world is the manifestation of his external potency. The living entities are also his marginal potency, and by their own choice they can live in either the transcendental or material worlds. The material world is not a fit place for living entities because they are spiritually one with the Lord. And in the material world, the living entities become conditioned by the laws of the material world. The Lord wants all living entities who are his parts and parcels to live with him in the transcendental world, and for enlightening conditioned souls in the material world, all the Vedas and the revealed scriptures are there expressly to recall the conditioned souls back home, back to Godhead. Unfortunately, the conditioned living entities, although suffering continually the threefold miseries of conditioned life, are not very serious about going back to Godhead. It is due to their misguided way of living, complicated by sins and virtues. Some of them who are virtuous by deeds begin to re-establish the lost relation with the Lord, but they are unable to understand the personal feature of the Lord. The real purpose of life is to make contact with the Lord and be engaged in his service. That is the natural position of living entities. But those who are impersonalists and are unable to render any loving service to the Lord have been advised to meditate upon his impersonal feature, the Virata Rupa, or universal form. Some way or other one must try to re-establish one's forgotten relation with the Lord if one at all desires to gain real happiness in life and to reclaim his natural, unfettered condition. For the less intelligent beginners, meditation on the impersonal feature, the Virata Rupa, or universal form of the Lord, will gradually qualify one to rise to personal contact. One is advised herewith to meditate upon the Virata Rupa specified in the previous chapters in order to understand how the different planets, seas, mountains, rivers, birds, beasts, human beings, demigods, and all that we can conceive are but different parts and limbs of the Lord's Virata form. This sort of thinking is also a type of meditation on the Absolute Truth. And as soon as such meditation begins, one develops one's godly qualities, and the whole world appears to be a happy and peaceful residence for all the people of the world. Without such meditation on God, either personal or impersonal, all good qualities of the human being become covered with misconceptions regarding his constitutional position. And without such advanced knowledge, the whole world becomes a hell for the human being. This verse is a continuing description of the Absolute Reality, conceived of as the universal form, and even though the term form is there, Virata Rupa, the tendency is for those who are attached to meditating or are conceiving of this universal form is to consider it ultimately formless. However, this is a stage in ascending to the full realization of the Supreme Absolute Truth, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It seems that it might be discussing something about some yogis in a past age, but similar principles apply in the modern age. As I'm sure you're all aware, we have plenty of impersonalism going around in the present age. minus the piety and the shastric orientation of Vedic culture. So it's nirvishesha shunyavadi paschatadeshi. It's impersonalism and voidism as, you can't even say practiced in the Western countries because there's no particular sadhana. At least impersonalists from a traditional background or voidists, they have some kind of strict sadhana, but in the modern world, it's you just feel yourself to be one with everything, or everything is one with me, or if anyone tries to discuss with you philosophically and you get a little lost in your lucubrations, then you just say that, well, it's all, words don't mean anything. As long as you feel like talking of all your nonsense, then you're very happy. But when someone says anything to counter, then it's all words. And to say words don't have any real meaning. So it is a kind of cheating position. Here we find that it's recommended that or it's not exactly recommended, but it's taken as a step. We have the previous to this chapter, we have the first step in God realization. Now the Lord in the heart, the first step in God realization is to understand the, or to conceive of a kind of a pantheistic vision. Pantheism is not actually theism. Theism must mean monotheism. The Supreme is, by definition, the Supreme cannot be more than one. If we say, well, I see many gods, well, that's immediately contradictory, because God means supreme, or I see everything as supreme. It's immediately, it becomes a meaningless statement, because supreme means asamordva, nothing equal and nothing superior to. That is the meaning of supreme. So to say that I see everything as supreme, it sounds as if one is having some cosmic realization. But actually, to use one of those words which Prabhupada often uses, and it just cuts through all this nonsense, it's nonsense. It's a very excellent word. Prabhupada liked to use this a lot. Nonsense. It immediately puts everything, all this ramblings, impersonal ramblings, in their place, in the garbage heap. So why is this considered a step on the path of God realization? There's so much, this impersonalism, it's this idea of God is everywhere, everything is supreme. It's actually an extreme type of self-indulgence, whereby people walk around in a cloud of imagination of considering themselves to be self-realized. But it can be a step in God realization if one gets association of devotees who see that there is some tendency towards God realization, even though it's contaminated or misconceived. Of course, this process here, the Vedic process, that helps one to develop piety by following the Vedic process, which is not there in the non-process of modern do-it-yourself impersonalism. That's not there, although they may be, they're usually vegetarians. But they're not so hot on the other principles, though. So, Gambling also, you don't find modern neo-impersonalists, you don't find them gambling much. And mostly they're vegetarians or vegans. But as far as the other two principles, no intoxication and especially no illicit sex, they're usually not very aware of the importance of this. They have no structured sadhana, no particular guidance or process for self-realization. They skip all that and just presume they're already self-realized, just by imagination. But still, that can be some kind of advantage to them, inasmuch as they mistake the devotees to be in the same kind of category as themselves. And they see that they consider devotees to be spiritualists like themselves. Of course, it's very difficult to understand what these people are thinking, because it is very confused, although they themselves think that they know what they're talking about, or they think that they consider themselves self-realized, but they are certainly in the category that Lord Krishna describes of vimuktamani. Actually, that's described by Lord Brahma when he's speaking. Now, even those who follow the Vedic process of impersonal self-realization and attain perfection in it, with great difficulty, kritchataha, the actual, can you sit like this? Can you practice? You're not practiced. Everyone's sitting at tables and chairs in the modern age, so you can't sit like this. Now, the actual process of self-realization by the impersonal method is undertaken with great difficulty, as Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita. Does anyone know that verse? The first word speaks of the difficulty. Can you say? Anyone can say? Klesho dikhatarastesham avyakta sakta chetasam avyakta hi gatir dukham dehavadbhiravapyate. So twice in this verse Krishna speaks of the difficulty. Arjuna asks Krishna about which is better, the impersonal system of meditation or just going directly to Krishna. And Krishna says, klesha adhikatara. There is much difficulty, not just difficulty, but much difficulty for those who are attached to the impersonal concept. He didn't say there's no difficulty in bhakti yoga, direct bhakti yoga. But he says there's much more on the impersonal path. And avyakta said, avyakta sakta chetasam. Then what's the next one? Avyakta hi gatir dukham. Although it's supposed to lead one to bliss, actually, for those who are embodied, it is simply a cause of distress. Now again, Lord Brahma states that yena ravindaksha vimukta maninas. Others who are not your devotees, he says to Lord Krishna, yena ravindaksha, you of beautiful lotus eyes, which the impersonalists deny, they're so unfortunate. Yen yen yavindaksha vimukta. They consider themselves to be fully liberated. Yen yen yavindaksha vimukta manas twayasta bhavad avishuddha buddhaya. But they don't have fully purified consciousness. But they think, I am pure. They are impure, even though aruhya, kritchrena, kritcha means, again, great difficulty. Aruhya, they ascend. Aruhya kritchrena parang patam, up to the spiritual atmosphere. But tataha, from there, patanti, they fall down. Adho, anarita yushvadangraha. They fall down because they neglect to worship Krishna's lotus feet. So although their consciousness is purified by not being engaged in gross sense gratification, it's still impure because they neglect to worship the lotus feet of Krishna, despite all the difficulties they take. So what to speak of a so-called New Age impersonalists who don't take any difficulty, and they just imagine themselves to be self-realized. But they have the same defect, that they neglect to worship Krishna, and they become interested in so many other processes. Just in the restaurant downstairs, seeing all this things, take this vegetable and you get this vitamin, and this is an antioxidant, and different teas for this and that. You just feel like giving up. It's too much, you know. You'll get stressed out trying to think about all the different antioxidants and things you have to take. It just drive you crazy. And at the end, you die anyway. So, however much vitamin E you take, anyway, you have to die. So it becomes like a big trip for them, keeping healthy, and they spend all their life keeping healthy. But what's the purpose of life? To serve Krishna, and that they miss it altogether. And they're very much concerned with being good and world peace, which is an impossible dream. They'll support so many causes, ecological cause and justice cause and so many causes, but it's not possible to make peace in this world because this is the world of exploitation. Even if they make the world very peaceful, why? So that everyone can peacefully enjoy sense gratification. But as soon as there's a question of sense gratification, then there's the question of exploitation. It's not possible to have sense gratification without exploitation, without misuse of others or ourselves. Just like they have this idea that, well, sexual relations are okay between consenting adults. So it doesn't matter. If you agree, it doesn't matter whether you're one or both are married to other people. It doesn't matter whether they're the same sex or different sex, and it's okay because they agreed. And the idea is that sex is for enjoyment, but they're wrong. Enjoyment is there, some enjoyment is there, but even biologically the function is for production of children. And understanding the laws of the universe, it's not only for producing children, that's there in animal life, but it's meant for, in human life, that is meant for producing children of higher consciousness. So the very idea that sex is meant for enjoyment is an animalistic concept, that I will enjoy some other body, and as long as that body agrees, then it's okay. But envy and exploitation being the nature of this material world, there's no pure love in this world, and so people come together on the basis of enjoyment, and then they go away again. They split up from each other, which causes unhappiness because they become emotionally attached. And in the meantime, there's production of children, or there's not production of children due to contraception, which is also sinful. It goes against the laws of the universe. So in this way, there's no possibility of producing the ideal society in which everyone can live, like John Lennon made his song, imagine all the people living for today, and there's no religion, and this is his vision of an ideal world. But even if somehow you could make the world into like one big ideal hippie commune, still there's death. So they're pursuing an impossible dream. Peace. We believe in peace, but there's no peace. It's not. Look all around you. All the plants and the trees and the animals and the birds, they're all fighting each other. It's all a big struggle. So that is the very nature of this material world. It is disharmonious. It must be, because every living being is attempting to exploit others and envy others. That people take pleasure in giving pain to others. That tendency comes out. Even if we try to make everyone nice and train them to, just like in the schools nowadays, they train in religious tolerance and everyone should be nice, but it doesn't happen. You say religious tolerance and someone else will come along and say, forget it, our way is the way, and they'll be intolerant of others. And then what do you do? If you say, just like Prabhupada, he so much criticized this idea of non-violence espoused by Mahatma Gandhi and others, that it's impractical. You say non-violence and someone will come along and take advantage. So you have to have violence, at least to control the bad elements in human society. It's a nice idea that everyone should be peaceful and tolerant and no one should do any harm to others. But if you live on that principle, or if you attempt to set up a society on that principle, very quickly everything will be stolen and people will be killed. And just like sometimes in America, I saw it, this is long in the past, I don't know about now, the police go on strike. Then immediately the people come with their trucks and just start looting the shops, because they know there's no one to stop them now. So the threat of punishment, we can understand from this that the threat of punishment, of force, stops people from being rascals. Otherwise, people would take advantage. New Orleans, the city was flooded, there's no law and order, and people descend to the lowest animal platform. People are surprised, but this idea, utopian idea of peace and love and tolerance and Stephen Covey, win-win and all this kind of thing, it's all based on the misconception that basically people are good, and if we're just nice to everyone, they'll be nice to us and we'll live a nice life. But actually it's true, by nature everyone is good, but in this material world that nature is perverted and everyone is trying to exploit everyone else. And if you, of course there are levels and degrees. It's just like one devotee was telling me, he was talking to an old man in Sweden who was a lawyer, and he said that when he began his practice 50 years ago, that business deals or property deals, they would be made with a handshake. When you shake hands, that's it. And whatever you said, that's it. And everyone will honor that. But nowadays you can't enter into any small business deal. You have to have it seen by a lawyer, and the fine print has to be seen. Because previously, people, they would just their word, and it's good enough. You don't know the man, but he's given his word, all right. But nowadays that's impossible. So, like that, the same devotee was telling me that even in his youth, in Germany, he's from, kind of from Germany, so in Germany it was like, there wasn't cheating in business. There was competition, and it was hard and it's tough, but there wasn't out and out cheating. But he said, now that's that ethic has gone and that's become normal. So this idea that we shall promote tolerance and peace and harmony without Krishna in the center is impossible. So we also stand for tolerance and peace and harmony. But tolerance doesn't mean tolerance of nonsense. People often say to me, why are you so uptight? Why are you so heavy? But why should we tolerate nonsense, which is neither beneficial for the person spouting it or anyone else who hears it? There's so many wrong ideas in modern society. This idea that everyone has the right to their own opinion. Why? People should know what is the right thing, and not just that you have your opinion. It's a common thing in Britain that people see devotees and they feel that now, you know, it's their duty to walk up to them and up to the devotee and tell them that, you know, actually, you got it all. This is the real thing. And the other day outside Soho Street, I was chanting my rounds, and someone came out of the nightclub and said, "There's no need to pray anymore. It's all been explained." I guess he meant the Quran. I don't know what. So, but anyway, I didn't listen to him, and then he didn't bother speaking anymore. But, you know, he's just come out of a nightclub and he's got to give me I've got it all wrong, so he feels it's his duty to tell me, no need to pray anymore. Just one example. So, this modern impersonalism, the idea everyone should have their own opinion, every opinion is as good as any other. I mean, from the very outset, it's ridiculous that every opinion is as good as any other. It sounds very, very wonderful. If you're a fool, it sounds wonderful. But obviously, it's not true. How is any opinion as good as any other? What it comes down to is that there's, as Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, asatyam apratishtam te jagadahuranishwaram. There's no actual truth. There's no actual basis or reality to anything. There's no God in control. So, kemanyat kama haitukam aparaspara sambhutam. There's no actual interaction or relationship between anything. There's no ultimate cause, because every aparaspara sambhutam means that everything, it actually means everything's coming into being by chance. Ever heard that one before? or that there's no actual relationship between, that everything that we see has no cause. The Vedic philosophy means to find out what is the ultimate cause. Atato brahma jignyasa janmadyasya yataha. This is the Vedanta Sutra. That having gone beyond the realm of material enjoyment, we should discover what is ultimate reality. What is ultimate reality? Janmadhyasya yataha. That which is the ultimate cause of everything. That is the pratishta. That is the basis of everything. But the demons, they say apratishta. There is no ultimate cause. So there's no need to study. Then there's no need to study Vedanta Sutra. There's no need to search, because there is nothing. It's just all. There's no cause. This book is here, but it's the book has no origin, and no one put it here. It's just there. Just be here now, and just experience what is here now. So it's actually a very demoniac philosophy. Kamanyat kama haitukam. Then what is left is only the only cause or the only reality is desire. It just comes down to gross animalism. The animal has no intellectual apparatus. The animal simply desires and acts on desire. That's all. So there's impersonalism, by which there's a general ethos of peace and love, but all undefined. Just some vague idea of peace and love and tolerance, but everything very vague. Whereas Krishna conscious means very clear. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satyadananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam. Very clear. Krishna is the Supreme Controller. There's rebellion against control. No, there should be no control. There should be anarchy. We should all just live. Anarchy as a political system doesn't inherently espouse chaos in society. It's just it's like an idea of pure communism without the official systems. There is no need of government. Actually, the original human society, it was anarchy. That's the highest. Before Varnashram, in the Satya Yuga, there was anarchy. Anarchy means there's no hierarchy. But that was possible because everyone was Paramahamsa. So there's no need of a social system because people aren't busy producing things. They're just living for the sake of the Absolute Truth. So for people of very high level, anarchy and then full freedom is a lack of any system, that is the best. But for people who are cultivating material desires, which means exploitation, the tendency to exploit others and to exploit the environment or everything around us, then some social system, some control is needed. Otherwise the material desires go out of control. Krishna is supreme, and the society should be organized to in such a way that people can be trained to understand this, to see that there is God, even to have a very vague idea, that is better than blunt atheism. But then who is that God? It's not something vague. People presume that God is just, well, you can believe in God or not. And then God, if you believe, you can believe in God any way you like. But it's another foolishness. Because He is as He is. He's not subject to our opinion. So Vedic knowledge, specifically that which is received in the Vaishnava Parampara, gives actual knowledge. Who is the Supreme? How we are to approach Him? Clear knowledge. Impersonalists don't like clarity. They like vagueness. Everything should be very vague. Vague sense of goodness. Vague sense of peace and harmony. But practical. What is practical? Meat eating should be stopped. They probably agree with that. But to stop the animal slaughter, you might have to slaughter a few humans. What do you think about that? If animal slaughter was to be stopped by law, then probably a lot of, maybe you don't have to slaughter them, but many humans would be very upset. So how are you going to have ultimate peace and harmony? How are you going to have absolute peace and harmony? Because some will object. Therefore, the authority is required in society. They want anarchy, but authority is required. Who will establish religious principles? And those who don't like, as Prabhupada actually said in one lecture, I never found it in the Veda base, I think they might have edited it out or not. He was talking about Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj's Parikshit's policy. I heard this after I was about 3 days in the ashram. Maharaj Parikshit's policy. Anyone is eating meat, kill him. Anyone is taking intoxication, kill him. Anyone is having illicit sex, kill him. Anyone is gambling, kill him. Very well remember hearing this. It was quite sensational among the devotees at the time that Prabhupada was saying this. There are some things which have been, you know, they're not putting it in the Veda base. I asked them, but they deny they left it out, but I'm pretty sure they are. So, it's, of course, Prabhupada wasn't recommending that we have such a policy, but he was saying this is Maharaj Parikshit's policy. That he didn't allow Kali. It was Kali Yuga came in. Kali Yuga actually officially started during the Kurukshetra War. But it's Kali's influence was held back until the day and moment that Krishna left this world, and then Parikshit Maharaj held it back more, and then Kali flooded in. But Parikshit Maharaj held this back, the four Kali sthans, the places of Kali, or the symptoms of Kali, meat eating, gambling, intoxication, illicit sex. So, if there is full Krishna consciousness, there won't be these things. But if there isn't full Krishna consciousness, but there's partial Krishna consciousness, and Prabhupada was advocating this, a Krishna conscious society. So Prabhupada was not so impractical that he thought that society could be organized without use of force. So these are some thoughts about the vague goodness of the impersonalistic people. Actually, as you know, very difficult to discuss with, because they don't believe in discussion. They just believe in feeling. Which means they, in a very puffed up way, they consider themselves to be right, and no one can tell them anything else because they feel like it. They put their feelings, their contaminated materialistic, which they consider to be spiritual, feelings above everything else. So it's very good if you could make some classes here. Classes in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness that bring people in and teach them systematically, step by step, the Vedic philosophy based on Bhagavad Gita. I saw in Latvia, of all places, well, why not? They've been quite successful over the last few years. They just take people in raw and give them classes in Vedic philosophy, and they start off with Ayurveda and astrology, and they talk a little bit about that, and then they get into Bhagavad Gita, and they make devotees. They take in, you know, like Neo-Mayavadis, and then gradually by from the beginning they say that everything has to be based on the Vedic scriptures, on Vedic authority. They make this, and then they gradually bring in all these different subjects, and then they. So this is a good way to take the interest of those who are somewhat sincere, of the impersonalists, or people have some interest in Eastern philosophy, and gradually take that and bring them to the right point. They actually do it quite effectively and quite quickly too. And those who are, you know, too envious, they drop out pretty quickly. And of course, the kirtan and the prasadam, everyone likes. So, that's one way of cutting through all this gunk of impersonalism, to give systematic training. And then if you start off with all these things like you know, Ayurveda, astrology, and then and people they can get in the if you tell them so many things which they don't know, then they get in the they get more in the mood of listening and learning, which is a big defect of our vimuktamanis, our so-called self-realized people. They don't want to listen because they think they know everything. But then if you can then you quote a few Sanskrit words which then explain what it means, maybe write something on the board, not like down here, how you have your I can't even say it's misspelled, it's like, you know, it's almost like an invented language or something. But if you can learn to write some things, one or two words in Sanskrit or something like this, and explain what it means, and then people might become a bit humble and then realize they don't actually know so much, and they'll like it too, because devotees are wonderful people, and by associating with them they'll begin to understand. If they're at all humble or sincere, they'll begin to realize that actually these people have got something that I haven't got. That was an immediate experience for me when I first came to the temple, was that these people, just by their whole attitude and their whole personality, they're radiating bliss. They're content. They're actually very, very happy, which I don't have. They've got something I don't have. How have they got that? Anyway, that's a suggestion. How to take people from the impersonal calamity, as Prabhupada wrote of his own Gurudev, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, impersonal calamity thou hast removed, absolute is sentient thou hast proved. And in all that poem, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took these two lines. As, yes, he has understood my mission. This is particularly important. Hare Krishna. Any questions, comments, protests? The protests you don't usually have to ask for. So Bhagavata Anand, you're now on the verge of retirement. Retirement in Krishna consciousness doesn't mean you sit at home and watch TV or go fishing. Prabhupada writes in the Nectar of Instruction, old men in the Western countries, they waste their time playing cards, fishing, watching television and doing all useless activities. But retirement in Krishna consciousness means to become more busy.
Sometimes shopping, sometimes you think that, oh, I told you all this money coming, yeah, the manager, this and that.
Yeah, yeah. Prabhupada said himself when he was called to take sannyas, his Guru Maharaj came in a dream and he just ignored it the first time. He thought, oh, it's just a dream. But then he realized he's serious about it. And he thought, how can I do it? Prabhupada said about himself, how can I leave my family? Although he had already left his family. But like to make the full break, like that, he thought, I found it very shocking. How can I be a sannyasi? That requires dependence on Krishna and not being attached to, just like you're a manager, and then you'll go from being a manager to a beggar. Yeah. Beggar for Krishna. But preaching Krishna consciousness is more valuable. And actually, generally speaking, we find that devotees, not in every case, but they become even financially more rich. Of course, they don't keep anything for themselves. But, you know, just like I'm probably earning at least as much as I would if I'd have gone then. If I hadn't joined this movement, then I'd have become, you know, my father wanted me to be a lawyer. Well, lawyers can make a lot of money. Lawyer by lying. Lawyer means liar. So, could have made money. But
one thing is sure, when you ask the question about the shloka, the wife, who's she saying the shloka?
She's up on the shlokas, yeah. She's ahead of you.
£1,000 doing part time, but then it's worth it.
Yeah. Anyway, money comes and goes. What do we need? Money for serving Krishna.
In the last few months, she was reading Parsi Bhagavatam.
Yeah, good. And learn shlokas and teach others. Teach the children. That's very good. If you teach the children shlokas, then that gives them, it gives them some kind of background, especially children from Indian background. It makes them feel as if they've got some religious background, and that will always be there. It's something parents in India, they very much like. Many of them, they send their children for shloka classes. You find the little kids, you know, they can learn chapters of Bhagavad Gita right off. You know, here we are, struggling all these years to remember our shlokas. Just like I remember, then I immediately forgot it, you see. But the kids, they learn it in childhood, they got it. So it's very good to teach the children shlokas. Of course, it's good to give the proper purport also, the understanding.
It's not connected with, my question is not connected with this verse, but it's in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna Leela. When Krishna, any asura who came to Vrindavan, Krishna killed the person within a second.
He took a little time in many cases. He played with them somewhat.
But when Kali serpent came,
Kaliya didn't kill him.
Krishna didn't kill him. He was the only asura who hasn't been killed. You have to understand why wasn't he killed if the rest of the asuras were killed.
I'm not remembering exactly now, but there was some. One thing is he had some benediction not to be. Another thing is Krishna enjoyed dancing on his head, so he took service from him. He did Rasleela with all the gopis on his head and thus purified him. Another reason is that he was dancing on his head, and then he was going to be finished off, and then the wives of Kaliya, who were all devotees of Krishna actually, they prayed for interceded on his behalf. So then Krishna didn't kill him, but he told him to get out of here and don't cause any disturbance again. So there are various reasons. His devotees praying for him. Don't kill. And he became purified by Krishna's dancing on his heads also. Then he himself prayed to Krishna. So Krishna is the protector of surrendered souls. So Kaliya became surrendered. Became a devotee, actually. Anything else?
Maharaj, you were talking about health and getting too caught up in this one. Vitamin, etc., people dealing with anxiety, just getting caught up in that. But devotees sometimes may get sick and they have to.
Yeah, sure. If you're sick, do what's necessary to keep healthy. Balance. Yukta ahara viharasya, yukta cheshtasya karmasya, yukta srapnava bhodasya. Yoga bhavati dukaha. Krishna recommends balance in our activities of eating, sleeping, recreation. One can practice so yoga like this. So one should know what one's. It's after some time one can come to know what one's body requires. and eat and act accordingly. But it's, I was just saying, you know, you could get just like too much into it, thinking, you know, I have to have this much, right? How much vitamin this did I take today? And it just becomes too much of a trip, you know. I was just thinking of so many people, even today, who live very unhealthy lives, and they live according to all these New Age ideas, and they still live long lives. My father's been smoking 30, 40 cigarettes a day since he was 10, and he's almost 80 now. So it's not necessarily true that all these... Whereas you find, you know, devotees who live quite healthy. I told him last year that, you know, so many devotees I know, they're all dying and this and that. And he said, oh, really? What, of cancer? He said, really? I thought it must be very healthy. So we find even pure vegetarians getting cancer, and people who live the most what we would consider unhealthy lives, living long lives. So it's not necessarily true that all this makes you live longer. But you have to see what's healthy for your body. That's like recently, less than a year ago, after all these years, one Ayurvedic doctor told me to eat earlier in the morning and take something a little solid in the morning. I used to just take fruit and this one Bhaskalavan Churna. So it was a very simple advice. It helped me so much. I used to have gas in my stomach. It was such... And then that would, you know, the gas goes to your head and then you feel... But very good advice. So... Often it's very simple. Of course, in the case of Radha Raman, it's complex case. But then it's very difficult to find anything that can help him either. It's just maybe a matter of time. I was... On health matters, I was speaking with Pankajangri Prabhu. You know, in Mayapur, world famous, even though he never goes out of Mayapur. Actually, he does some. His Jananiva stays there all the time. So... We were discussing about doctors and this, and you find some doctors are reputed, but then many, so devotees all start going to this particular doctor, and then they find that he cures some and some he doesn't. So Pankajanri Prabhu was saying, well, it's like your karma, your fate. When it's time for you to be cured, you'll meet the right doctor. And you can go to a good doctor, but if it's not time for you to be cured, then you won't be cured. So, and even you see, just like Tribhuvanath Prabhu, he worked his body, and he didn't care about his health, and then his body broke down, and he left this world. Jayaprataka Maharaj, for years, everyone around him has been telling him to slow down. He's not slowing down, but. To wear out the body in the service of Krishna and go back to Godhead, that's from the Krishna conscious point of view a lot more than living, you know, maybe 3 years longer and just relaxing so you can stay healthy. So we should try to stay healthy. We should see the warning signs in our body, and it depends on our constitution also. Some people have very strong constitution, like Jayaprataka Maharaj, or maybe that's just due to his strong desire to preach Krishna consciousness, that he has a strong constitution. But generally big-bodied people do, although we shouldn't think of a Vaishnava as their body. But we have to see, the whole point is we have to see how best to serve Krishna with the particular bag of bones that we're presently incarcerated in. And we have to see how best to do that. And usually in youth we don't understand how fragile these bodies are, because whatever you do in youth, the body bounces back and it feels like, you know, I can go on forever, but then after some time it stops bouncing back, or it takes slower to bounce, or there's a health breakdown or something like that. So some intelligence is required also, but not becoming like so much into health that, you know, I can't go to Mangalarti because of health reasons. I have to sleep more later. that is. For our spiritual health, we require that. This is anathema to those who put, you know, the health freaks, that who think that the most important thing is having a healthy body, but what it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is what we do with our body. It's not, you'd be so healthy, but what for? You could spend all day every day. Like you get up, you do yoga, and then you go for a swim, and then you sort out your diet, and then you do some meditation and relaxation. You could spend your whole day just doing different things. Then you could have some magnetic treatment, and you know, you could spend your whole day doing different. Go for a massage. And you could spend your whole day just getting treated to be healthy. But then, what are you going to do with it? What are you living for? So we should do what is required to keep this as far as possible, because it's not in our hands anyway, to keep this body healthy to serve Krishna. But the point is to serve Krishna. And it's preferable to be sick and serve Krishna than healthy and not serve Krishna. I was just thinking, because seeing all that, it like puts you in anxiety, you know. Am I getting enough of this vitamin, and maybe I have to take more carrots, and you know, it just puts you in anxiety. And then I think, well, even if I don't take the carrots, you know, I'm going on anyway, so. Actually, it is very good, carrot juice. Gives you a zing. It's the non-caffeine zing. Although it's, according to Shastra, carrots are actually forbidden. I don't know why, because it's very, very good food. But any red food, it seems, it's not allowed. And that's one thing I want to research. Why? What's the reason? Of course, the carrots we use are not those indigenous in Indian culture, in this Kali Yuga. There's a different... The indigenous Indian carrot is somewhat different. It's, have you seen that? It's more red-purple kind. It's not so juicy either. You haven't seen that. But now that you don't see that carrot much now. It's mostly all the orange-coloured carrot.
In India, people don't eat rabbit. They say that it's for rabbit, not for human beings.
They don't eat carrots, no. Not much. Yeah. But everything will change. They didn't used to take tomato because it's not indigenous. Bilati begun, they used to call. Bilat. Foreign, but now everyone takes. They were so strict, the British would import sugar and people didn't want to take it because it's coming from overseas. It's impure. They didn't want to touch the cloth coming from England, impure. They were so strict.